Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, this is a great time to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And of course, Zorba, along with our calls, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes. What happens when you leave the hospital? What are your risks? And how do those risks essentially affect your life? And we're talking about the risks of medications, whether or not they're continued or discontinued. It's a problem, the handoff. We'll talk about new research on that. And then we're going to talk about ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, some new important, exciting research that may affect especially families who have Lou Gehrig's disease in their genotype.
Exciting research is really good. I'm looking forward to that. What's our recipe?
Absolutely. Our recipe is stuffed cherry tomatoes, a good way to use tomatoes during this high tomato season.
And I think we'll be served this dish during the program.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe we're going to be served the dish. That means it was made by our producer, Adam, the chef of the day.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, let's welcome our first caller, a listener with us now in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, my daughter is 2 years old, and when she was 6 months old, she started getting fevers that were very high, and they've come regularly. Every month, they'll go as high as 107 and will last over a week long. And it was diagnosed as periodic fever syndrome, and she was put on a drug called colchicine that gave us a break for about 2 or 3 months, but then it came back. So I was just curious if you had any ideas. We'd heard that potentially it could be allergy-related because it started once she began eating foods, but we would just love any advice.
Oh, sure. How old is she now?
She just turned 2.
Okay, she just turned 2. And how often do the fevers actually occur?
Well, we can almost mark it on a calendar that it was every 30 days.
Wow.
So it would last about 8 days.
They last for about 8 days. That is a long time.
And doesn't 107, isn't that high?
Absolutely.
Even for a child?
Absolutely. 107 is very, very, obviously is very, very high. And your child must be very uncomfortable when she has a fever that high. What do you give her for the fever, by the way?
Well, we do Tylenol and Advil alternating. And sometimes that will help to break it, but it'll just come right back.
How far down does the fever go? When it goes, when you actually break it, does it go to 101 or 98?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. 101, maybe 100.
Okay. Let's go back to this and the colchicine. Who have you seen in Buffalo? You know, what sort of doctors have you gone to?
Well, we did spend some time in the hospital just getting everything tested and ended up with a pediatric rheumatologist.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's the one who put my daughter on colchicine.
And have you seen anybody in infectious disease at all, or have you seen?
Actually, yes. That was when she got all the testing done. They did look at her.
Okay, so you had infectious disease. You had a rheumatologist. How about an allergist?
We've never seen an allergist.
A couple of thoughts with this. First of all, I've heard of this syndrome. I'm obviously not an expert in this syndrome. It's an unusual thing. And I think the real issue is that the diagnosis, or is there something else going on? So if this were my child and, you know, if I were given a medication, like you said, colchicine, which is a drug that's normally actually used for inflammation in gout, and it worked, obviously I wouldn't be calling the station and looking for another opinion because my child would be better. But I think in this case, the most important thing is to find out what's going on. And one diagnosis by one specialist is great, but if it doesn't actually fit that diagnosis, or if your child isn't any better, I would recommend a second opinion. There are two And there are two ways I would do it. First of all, I definitely would get an opinion by an allergist. That's what I would do. But then sometimes if I'm not sure what's going on, my thought is you go to another specialist, such as a rheumatologist or a pediatric ID specialist, 100 miles away, if my insurance covers it. And the reason why I like to go 100 miles away is I really want to get a second opinion from somebody who doesn't know the person who gave the first opinion. And then I'm more likely to really get an opinion that says, yes, I think this is what's going on. But a fever that high of 107 on a regular basis, you really – it's not clear to me what she has, and it may not be clear to others. And I think you've got to look at other things.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You know, that's the very difficult thing. Like you said, Tom, 107 is really, really high. You've got a diagnosis made. It's an unusual syndrome, periodic fever syndrome. And what do you do when you've got something like that?
Why did you suggest an allergist? Could an allergy in a young child cause that kind of a fever?
Well, allergists not only deal with fever, but they often deal with things that are inflammatory in nature. So allergists deal with asthma. Asthma is not an infection. It's not an allergy, but it's in the same mindset. Allergies and asthma can go hand in hand. But the real issue is there's something that's setting this off. Is there something of an allergic type reaction that she's having that's actually producing a high fever? So I think looking at an allergist is an excellent idea. Once again, it's another view of what's happening with this child from another specialist. But when you've got something like this that is not clear, not easy to solve, and is going on, the question is this the right diagnosis? And that's where you've got to have another person basically look at the problem.
Thanks again for the call. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I have a daughter who's 28, and she's been suffering from endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of a where-do-we-go-from-here question. She had a child 3 years ago, and she's been really, really suffering ever since then. And she's had six surgeries. She's had a hysterectomy. She's had her ovaries removed. And now she's on hormone replacement therapy. And she did really well for a while. I mean, for the first time in years, I saw her, you know, skipping around the yard and so forth. But about a month ago, she started getting sick again, and she doesn't have anything except for the hormone replacement therapy that could cause it. Nobody really knows what it is. We went back to the gynecologist, and he basically said, you know, she doesn't have any female organs left. So he sent her to the emergency room to test for other things, and we've tried to think of who could help her. Like, there's general surgeons, they say, no, they don't have enough knowledge of endo. Urologists, gastrointestinal doctors work from the inside, not from the outside. We don't really know even that she has endometriosis back.
Right. In fact, if we look at let's look at what your daughter had generally. She had endometriosis, which is really where the endometrium, the lining of the uterus, is not in the uterus. It's in the abdomen. So,
right.
You know, the tissue is in the abdomen. So when you go through the normal hormonal process, you've got endometrial tissue there. It bleeds. Blood is very irritating to the body and is very painful. And your daughter obviously had a very severe case of it and had, like you said, hysterectomy. Most importantly, her ovaries were removed. So, you know, her ovaries are not there, and she's on hormone replacement therapy. And you have to look at two things. First of all, the endometrium that they may have removed during the surgery may not have been completely removed. There might be pieces of endometrium somewhere else, you know, that they just didn't see. Because they look in the belly, and the endometrium, you know, can be in hidden places, and they may not have seen it. My first thought is, with your daughter, is to stop the hormone replacement therapy completely. You know, just stop that. See whether or not that indeed is the issue. It's not going to be from a point of view of osteoporosis, which is the issue when you stop female hormones. We can deal with that with other medications there that are fairly effective, but it's not going to make a difference over a 2 or 3 month period at all. I mean, she may
what
go.
What do you do about like hot flashes?
You deal with the hot flashes.
Like
you deal with it by taking black cohosh, or going on Paxil or Prozac, which are antidepressants that work with hot flashes. And you see, gee, do I have endometrium down there? I don't know. Stop my hormones for 3 to 6 months. If my pain goes away, then indeed I do have some endometrial tissue there. And if it were my body, I would say, let me deal with the hot flashes in alternative ways, and let me stop the hormones completely. Because if you stop the hormones, the endometrium should not be bothersome. That's number one. Number two is she might have something else going on. She could have adhesions in the abdomen. These are pieces
of
scar.
She did have adhesions. In one of her surgeries, she had adhesions.
Right. So that could be the issue. Adhesions are where there's scar tissue, and the scar tissue itself causes pain. The problem is you can't see adhesions on any scanning techniques, and so sometimes you have to go in with a scope, and you have to take the adhesions out, and that can be problematic. But I think I would stop. If it were me, my recommendation is stop the hormones for 3 months, see what happens.
Okay.
Call us back and let us know.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you for the call at 1-800-462-7413.
You know, as with our first caller, one of the issues is that, gee, I'm trying to figure things out. My physicians don't know what's going on. How do I get a second opinion? What do I look for? And, you know, for the most part, we doctors are really, really good. Most doctors are very good at common things that they see all the time. But it's those rare birds that become very, very difficult. And sometimes if one thing doesn't work, you have to go to a secondary site where the doctors there see the rare birds. And to me, that's where places like Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, great universities really serve a purpose. They serve a purpose in that they have people there who see the unusual things. So for them, they're more common.
Yeah. Now, before our next call, Zorba, you mentioned a study on medications patients use when leaving the hospital.
Right. This is an important study. It's a big issue. It's very important, essentially, for what I call the electronic medical record or the electronic health record, which is going to help curb problems like this. So you go into the hospital, all right? You have a certain number of medications. Your doctor may be the doctor who is admitting you or someone else, and a medication might be there or might be missed going into the hospital. As you can imagine, you might bring your pills with you, but you forgot your pills at home. Or you didn't bring your pills with you and the pills are listed on the chart, but they're not complete. Mm-hmm. Leaving the hospital, the same exact problem can occur. And this particular study looked at Canada. Looked from 1997 to 2009. They went through all the hospitalizations, outpatient hospitalizations in Ontario, Canada. And those were nearly 400,000 patients. Mm-hmm. And the reason why Canada is a good place to look at this is they have one healthcare system. It's called the government.
Yeah.
And they have one insurance company. It's called the government. Yeah. And so they could keep track of health records and find out whether or not, medications were incorrectly discontinued, errors of omission. Mm-hmm. In other words, we forgot to do it. They looked at statins, drugs like Lipitor. They looked at antiplatelet drugs, drugs such as Plavix or aspirin. They looked at thyroid. They looked at respiratory inhalers for asthma, and they looked at things such as a Prilosec to reduce acid in the stomach, and lo and behold, they found there was a huge number of unintentional medications that were lost from the point of view of the patient being discontinued from the hospital to the point of view of where they saw their doctor in the office.
But aren't they pretty careful at hospitals and giving patients written instructions on what medications to take?
You would think, wouldn't you? Wouldn't they be careful? And the answer is they are careful, but essentially there was a 10% rate of discontinuation of antiplatelets. In other words, you're in the hospital, you should be discharged. We'll say on aspirin or Plavix to make sure you don't have a heart attack or a stroke. 10% of the people didn't get the drug. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, 10% of 400,000 is a big number. When they looked at inhalers, it was 5%. That's a big number. I mean, that's not a small number at all. If we look overall, if they were in the ICU, it was even a higher number. In other words, medications are dropped inappropriately when they leave the hospital. So the real question is, how do we fix it?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. One way to fix it, I think, is through the electronic medical record. I think that's going to begin to address part of the problem because it'll say, hey, wait a minute, this person was on it, they're being discharged. A little alarm will go up and say, hey, wait a minute, do you really want to stop this medication? That's one way. Yeah. The other way, I think, is if you are picking up someone at the hospital and the nurse will say, or the discharge planner, or the doctor is going over medications, you as a patient have to say, can we look at all those medicines again and make sure? I want a second look.
Well, I'm just wondering if part of the problem isn't patients being, you know, too sick to understand what medications
they
should.
Absolutely.
Change you make, that's not going to solve that problem.
Well, that's why it's really important to have an advocate with you when you leave the hospital. You want to make sure you have an advocate with you that's going over the medication. So let's say the nurse goes in the room with the patient and says, okay, these are the following 10 medications you're on. Take these, and sits down with the patient. And then you, Tom Clark, go to pick up, you know, your friend or your wife.
Yeah.
And your wife says, oh, I've got the list of medications from the nurse. The answer is no. You've got to go over that with the nurse too. In other words, that second look upon discharge is going to make it more likely, because when we look at a 5 to 10% error rate on drugs that may be life-saving, this is a very important issue, because it may be more likely that if the person isn't on it, they're going to be back in the hospital and have a complication. So you're right. Second look by the advocate, that's where it's at.
1-800-462-7413. It's, of course, toll-free, and a line is open for you now at 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener now, Zorba, in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, I have a bunion, and my doctor, who I love, has told me that it's okay to just sort of live my life, until which point it starts to interfere and it starts to give me discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister-in-law also had a bunion. And without being, you know, counseled to do so, she sort of took the same approach. But when she finally showed it to her doctor, he was kind of frustrated with her that she hadn't brought it up earlier, and gave her the impression that the longer you waited, the harder it was to perform the surgery. So my question is, when do you know that it's time to have bunion surgery done?
Now, her doctor was a family doctor or a podiatrist? What was her doctor?
Honestly, I'm not sure.
Okay. So, first of all, there's no risk in waiting for bunion surgery.
Okay.
Now, my podiatric friends may disagree with me, but I have lots of patients with bunions who never get surgery and it doesn't get worse. And then I have other patients who have bunions and it does get worse. And bunions are more common in women than they are in men, because they are basically a problem with high-heeled shoes, which on the whole men do not wear. Women who wear 3-inch spikes are much more at a risk for getting a bunion, but they run in families too, and they run in people who engage in certain athletic things such as soccer. Do you have a family history for bunions?
No, I don't, but mm-hmm. I've been running and playing competitive sports for pretty consistently for probably the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, and so that's really what it comes. It's a traumatic thing. There's a heel on the shoe and other things. You can basically wait as long as you want to. Bunion surgery is painful surgery. I mean, that's often why people, you know, avoid it, and they say, you know, it's painful, and nobody wants surgery unless they really need it. How symptomatic is your bunion, or did the doctor just find it when they looked at your foot?
It really came to my attention when somebody looked at my foot and said, whoa, what's going on there?
Uh-huh.
And I looked down and I said, hey, yeah, that's not real symmetrical, is it? And,
mm-hmm. You don't have much in the way of symptoms at all.
Well, I guess maybe the question is, what are the symptoms of a bunion?
Pain and discomfort. Pain.
Pain and discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Pain. Do you have pain?
I don't have pain.
You don't have pain. Mm-hmm. So if I had a bunion and I didn't have pain, would I get the bunion worked on? No. I wouldn't do it. I would watch it though, and if it started getting worse and worse and worse, I'd probably get, you know, get the surgery. But as I said, there are a lot of people with bunions who never have the surgery and they're never bothered. So good luck to your sister. Best of luck to your sister. And I, once again, you can wait on your bunions. Do not be disturbed.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call. You know, if I had a bunion and Doc chewed me out for not seeing him or her soon enough, and then the operation took place and it was fine, I'd wonder, what's he talking about? Is she talking about?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And that's what he was asking about. He doesn't have any symptoms.
Yeah, it doesn't make
if you notice, sense. when he said thank you at the end, it was the thank you of, oh, I'm relieved I don't have to have this operated on. Well, that's why I wondered who the doctor was. Maybe she went to a podiatrist, and podiatrists do lots of bunion surgery, and they'll say, well, you should have it done now versus later. And, you know, sometimes you wonder if you really have to have it done.
Mm-hmm. Well, Zorba, before we step out for a short break, it's time to test you on the advice speed bag during another round of rapid fire.
Woo-hoo!
Are you ready?
I am ready.
First up is Sean from Appleton, Wisconsin, who heard your advice to avoid cooking with coconut oil, but he wants to know if it's okay for other uses, specifically his wife's foot rubs.
Absolutely. You can use all the coconut oil you want to as long as you don't ingest it, because tropical oils are really not too good for us.
Now let's see if we can help out Peggy with a biting issue. She writes, how do I treat the maddening itching of spider bites? Any tips on getting skin to heal up after I've been bitten?
Well, as we did with our children, we called it clown medicine. You know what clown medicine is, Tom?
No.
Calamine lotion.
Oh,
because
okay.
When you put it on the bite, it tends to look like a clown all spotted up.
Let's move from skin to breath with a quick question from Sharon. Several years ago, you mentioned a product to improve breath. I'm a longtime vegetarian, and my diet consists of lots of garlic and onions. Can you tell me what that product was?
Well, the product, first of all, first thing you do is brush your teeth. Second thing you do is floss your teeth. And the third thing you actually do is get something such as Listerine, anything else that has enough alcohol in it to do the difference, not the non-alcoholic mouthwash, and make sure that you leave it in your mouth for a full minute, and that will tend to work. If not, there's a prescription product you can get from your dentist, and the name slips my mind.
Okay, now to an anonymous question about Viagra. Dear Zorba, I take Viagra from time to time to help with sexual matters. I'm wondering what the long-term use of that drug will mean for my sex drive. If I use the drug, am I stuck with always depending on
it? Not at all. If you use the drug, you simply use it as stated on the drug insert, and it should not affect your sex life. It doesn't affect anything in the long term, so use it as you need
it. But my guess is the older you get, the more you're going to need, not less.
I think you're right, Tom.
Finally, in that same vein, a listener named Kevin shares his variation on some cliched advice. For years, I've told my coworkers when I'd hear them sneeze or cough, etc., like my doctor used to say, take two aspirin, go to bed with someone, and call me in the morning. And then I'd advise, and if that don't work, stop taking the aspirin. Well, we've worn out Zorba during this edition of Rapid Fire, but make sure to get your question in for our next round. Just send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Recipe time, that's coming up next. More of your questions, of course, some more interesting research to talk over, and we have a medical myth buster for you later in the hour, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phones, recipe time. This one for stuffed cherry tomatoes, which both Zorba and I are looking at as we speak.
I love tomatoes. Do you love tomatoes?
I like tomatoes.
Oh, I love tomatoes.
I like them a lot. Hard to get good tomatoes anymore in the store.
That's right. Well, it's hard to get good tomatoes, but it's not hard to get good tomatoes in season.
When you're growing them.
Right, when you're growing them. Yeah. And I remember when I was in college, I didn't have a lot of money, and it's very interesting. I had to choose between fluid milk, powdered milk, and tomatoes. In other words, if I wanted tomatoes, I didn't have enough money, then I had to have powdered milk. And if I didn't have tomatoes, then I had enough money for fluid
milk.
My
goodness.
But I have to tell you, I was thinking about this the other day.
Yeah.
There's something that I never put in that equation. I tell my kids about it. I couldn't afford the powdered milk. I smoked cigarettes at that time, and it never occurred to me that if I quit smoking, I wouldn't have enough money for fluid milk and tomatoes.
And a few steak dinners to boot.
Steak dinners. That didn't occur to me until my junior year in college that I said I can't afford smoking because it went up from 32 cents to 35 cents. I am so glad it went up those 3 cents because that made a difference.
So let's do stuffed cherry tomatoes.
Yes. Okay. So start out with 8 ounces of feta cheese. Cut into small cubes or that feta that's crumbled around.
8 ounces feta cheese cut into small cubes.
2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
That's right. 1/4 teaspoon of red chili flakes.
1/4 little tea, red chili flakes.
Lemon zest. You've got to get a lemon and zest a lemon.
Lemon zest.
Now, how do you zest your lemon?
How do I zest it?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you take a thing and scrape off the peel?
Right. But there is a difference in the scrapers. And I recommend to everyone that they get Microplane. MicroPl, I think it's A-N-E.
Is that a brand name for one of the scrapers?
And I'll put it on. We'll put it on our website, zorbapastor.org. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. I don't own stock in the company. In fact, I think it's privately owned. It is absolutely the best instrument to use for shredding Parmesan cheese or for zesting. And this guy, there was an article about him in the New York Times maybe a couple of months ago, but we've had this for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
He was a woodworker, and he made his own planes to be able to plane down his woodworking and his carpentry. And his wife took the plane one day and decided that she was going to use it for the Parmesan cheese. It works so much better than anything. I highly recommend
it.
What's
the name of it again?
Microplane. MicroPlane.
If I ever want to zest anything, I'll go out and get one of
those. And I'll tell you something. It's a great gift to give for people. I know no one's thinking about Christmas, but it's a great gift. Okay. 1 tablespoonful of minced shallots.
A big tea, minced shallot.
1 tablespoonful of fresh basil chopped.
A big tea, fresh basil chopped.
1/2 teaspoon of chopped fresh oregano. And for that matter, any other fresh spice you might have around.
Mm-hmm. 1/2 little tea. Chopped fresh oregano.
1 pound of cherry tomatoes, large cherry tomatoes.
A pound of cherry tomatoes.
And then we'll have some salt and pepper to taste.
S&P.
Okay, so toss the feta, oil, chili flakes, lemon zest, shallots, basil, and oregano in a bowl. Season with some salt and pepper. Taste it, of course. Then cut the tomatoes in half. Scoop out the pulp. And it's very important. With a little small spoon or a melon baller really works best. You can't do it with a big spoon. Place the tomato shells on a serving plate. Sprinkle with a little salt and pepper. Then stuff the shells with the marinated feta. Drizzle with additional olive oil if desired. And enjoy. And I can see Tom is chewing.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Kudos to you for the recipe. Kudos to Adam Friedrich for the putting it all together. Delicious.
Mm. Heavenly.
So
I am in tomato heaven.
So if I want to get this recipe.
It's incredible. You know, through you can get it on your iPhone, on your iPad, on your Android, on your computer, anywhere where you've got electricity and a computer by going to zorbapastor.org. You can download this recipe. You can download other recipes from our archives. You can sign up for our weekly podcast. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook at zorbapastor.org.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
How are you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
I'm calling, actually, just for the fact that my friend and I, we get into a debate every time we go to a movie because I work long days, but I usually start to get a little tired and fall asleep when my body overheats. I get really hot and really sleepy. He says because I work too much and too long of hours. And I tell him, no, it's just because I'm really, really hot. And I get my body temperature is a little bit higher than normal. So every time we would do something that I would get hot, I'd immediately get tired, a little lethargic. And as a kid growing up, I was an insomniac, so I'd stay up for days on end, run on days for like an hour or two of sleep a day. And lately, it's like the past few years, every time I get really hot, I start to fall asleep, even doing nothing. My body would heat up really quickly.
What kind of work do you do?
I'm a delivery driver for a restaurant here in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
So what time do you go to sleep at night? How many hours a night of sleep are you getting at night?
I get between 2 to 4 hours of sleep a night.
Oh, so that's
all. I can't really sleep that well.
So that's all you're doing. You're getting 2 to 4 hours of sleep at night, and you know, you're what's happening is you're catnapping during the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's. I've got a question. Why are you only getting 2 to 4 hours of sleep a night? I could not survive on that for more than a day.
Well, I had a very bad car accident back in 2009, where I broke pretty much every bone in my body.
Wow.
And it causes me very, very uncomfortable feeling of pain in my back.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. When I wake up, I'm fully refreshed, recharged. Even after 30 minutes to an hour, I'm ready to go.
But obviously, you know, affecting your life during the daytime. I've got a couple of suggestions for you. I have a few suggestions. First of all, I think the way to attack this is to attack the sleep problem in the evening. I think that's the first line of attack. I think during the day, what's happening is, you know, you need a certain amount of sleep. Humans need generally 6 to 8 hours of sleep a night. Some need a little more. Some need a little less. 2 to 3 hours does not do it. That's absolutely out of the curve. And so what you want to do is say, what am I going to do to have better sleep hygiene? That's kind of the word that we used for it. How am I going to, you know, get the right amount of sleep and sleep hygiene? So I suggest a few things. First of all, I think you got to call your doctor. I would suggest you try a pill called gabapentin, G-A-B-A. Pentin, P-E-N-T-I-N. It's a generic pill. It's used for people with chronic pain. It is not a narcotic, and it is not addictive. And I'd recommend somewhere in the dosage of 300 milligrams to 800 milligrams at bedtime and see what that does. It's got two advantages. A, it helps a lot with a lot of people with chronic pain. It reduces the sensitivity of the nerves in your body that are around the muscles and the bones that are firing when you move your body. And B, it actually, the side effect is sleepiness. That's what I'd recommend. And I'd recommend trying that, see if that works. Second thing is go to Google and write down sleep hygiene, Mayo, M-A-Y-O, Mayo Clinic. They've got a great article on sleep hygiene. And read about it. You can also put insomnia Mayo and you'll pull up a whole thing and follow that. There are instructions of what to do in the room, how to set up your bed and so on. Because I think you need better sleep hygiene and something to reduce your pain at night. That's where you got the most bang for your buck. You're falling asleep during the day because you're not having enough sleep at night. So we got to fix that and make that sleep longer so that you can get into good REM sleep and let your brain do what it has to do. That's my suggestion.
Yeah, I'd definitely do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, my friend always said I do Da Vinci sleep.
Da Vinci sleep, what's that?
He said he saw it on Seinfeld where it's like 20 minutes of sleep, 10 minutes of sleep a day, or 20 minutes of sleep and you're refreshed. You have all these ideas and then you just periodically throughout the day take 20 minutes to yourself and sleep and that's it.
Da Vinci sleep.
I'm like, that's not genius sleep. That's just napping here and there.
Yeah, that's just napping near the. Unless you happen to be Leonardo da Vinci, in which case it is genius sleep. Or Thomas Edison sleep. That's the way he slept too.
In the kitchen, maybe. In the kitchen, maybe.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you very much.
Yep. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And before we close out our recipe segment, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for a listener tip from fan of the show, Carol. On a past show, Carol heard us discussing our opinion on the best oil for popping popcorn. Well, for Carol, the best oil is none at all. She writes, Dr. Zorba, Popcorn is one of my favorite foods. I stopped popping with oil years ago, and I don't have an air popper or pop microwave popcorn from the store. I learned that with a brown paper lunch bag, you can add a couple handfuls of dry popcorn, fold the top over 1/2 inch a couple of times, and lay it on the microwave and hit the popcorn button. Be careful to listen for the corn to stop popping because you don't want it to burn. Then you can add a tablespoon or less of melted butter and salt.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Of course, melted butter is oil. So, but that's a neat way to do it. Great idea. I love the concept. People have microwaves. I mean, it's easy to do. And I didn't realize that you don't need any oil at all, but it doesn't make sense that you'd really need oil to pop popcorn. I love it. I think our viewers are going to love it too. There are, by the way, old-fashioned ways of using popcorn. Yeah. We've got a swirly gig, I think it's called. We put a tablespoonful of oil in there. But hey, minimal oil for the popcorn makes it healthier.
You know what our viewers are looking at? The radio or the car dashboard or out the window.
There you go, Tom. I love it.
If a lifestyle tip pops into your mind, make sure to send it to the show. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Another interesting topic to talk over, more of your calls and our medical myth buster. Lots of good reasons for you to stick with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, some info on Lou Gehrig's disease.
That's right. Lou Gehrig's disease, which, you know, as many people know, is sort of a – well, it's not sort of. It is a neurological degeneration where your nerves stop functioning correctly. Mm-hmm. It affects muscles. Those are the muscle aspects of our body, so our ability to speak, our ability to swallow, our ability to move. And as you know from Stephen Hawking, the most famous, you know, Lou Gehrig sufferer who's lived longer than anyone I know, I mean, incredibly long time, you know, you lose the ability to be able to function except on a minimal basis, but your mind keeps going.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect your mind at all. It's named after Lou Gehrig, and in fact, there are questions whether or not Lou Gehrig really died of Lou Gehrig's disease or whether or not he had another neurological degenerative disease that may be different, and that in itself is very interesting.
I guess we'll never know the
answer. We won't know. We will not know the answer. But the issue is Lou Gehrig's runs in families, so you can have familial Lou Gehrig, and by looking at families, what they found was that there is a mutation that produces a protein that may be responsible for the issues, the defect in this protein synthesis, essentially, may cause Lou Gehrig's disease. And by getting rid of this mutation, by allowing this protein to be developed, we may actually have a cure to Lou Gehrig's disease.
Wow, there's some hope here.
There is some hope. The problem is we have no treatment at all. The lack of this protein essentially leads to this neurological degeneration. And Lou Gehrig's occurs in a sporadic form, you know, suddenly where people probably have the mutation. But the familial form is about 10% of the cases. And often, by studying familial problems within medicine, we can find out where the problem is and begin to then develop a methodology of striking at that problem. And well, I think this is really exciting.
Would this prospective cure just cure one kind of Lou Gehrig's disease or all of them?
Well, I find it fascinating that we have now found a protein that may be in a mutation that may find where the problem is. If we look at other diseases where protein is important, for instance, Alzheimer's disease, where amyloid, which is another protein, is important, this may open up a whole new realm of therapy in the future that may help things like Lou Gehrig's disease, maybe Parkinson's disease, and maybe things such as Alzheimer's disease. It's very exciting because a lot of these seem to be, you know, DNA, if you will, based problems.
So often we hear about these wonderful prospects, but then they really don't.
Well, that's because it takes years and years and years to then develop the drugs that can actually then actually pinpoint what we're doing. But I think for people with Lou Gehrig's disease, this is a major step forward. Finding where the genetic defect is may allow us to actually develop therapy that can fight the disease.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. You'll find a line open if you'd like to join us. Our next caller, Zorba, is in Winchester, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I was calling in regards to my 2-year-old daughter. She is diagnosed with a rare genetic metabolic disorder, which is called VLCAD. And part of her treatment and routine blood work include acyl carnitine panels and carnitine panels. Her most recent lab work showed that her carnitine levels were low, so they prescribed carnitine, which she's been taking now for 3 weeks. My question is how to reduce the side effects that she is having from taking the carnitine. And those side effects are vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. And as part of her VLCAD, she has to maintain anything that she takes into her body because she has to survive on carbohydrates because she is missing the enzyme to break down fat for energy.
So I want to go back to the metabolic disorder. How old is your child now?
She's 2.
Okay, she's 2. How is she in terms of her height and weight, in terms of development?
She is off the charts for her height, and she is in the 95th percentile for her weight.
Okay, so in other words, she's thriving. Would you say that in terms of energy and her ability to move around, or is she lacking energy?
No, she is not lacking energy at the moment, but only when she goes into a metabolic crisis.
Right, right. And with all metabolic disorders, such as PKU, phenylketonuria, which where you can go into a crisis because you eat a certain amino acid, or maple syrup urine disease, these are specialized diets that you have to be on for life. How is she doing on that diet? She can't. Now, I'm not as familiar with this metabolic problem. She can't digest any fat.
Well, she has to have – she's only allowed 10 grams of fat in a day because she has to have it, of course, for brain and, of course, for development.
Right, right.
She, so, yes, mostly her treatment is her diet. So she can't have more than 10 grams of fat, and we have to maintain around 1,300 calories every day. Otherwise, her body starts tapping into her muscles for energy and breaking down and setting up protein in her body.
Right, right, right. Right, because fat is really fat for us is really a storehouse of energy, and basically she doesn't have that storehouse of energy. It's storehouse of energy to actually go back on. What sort of fat do you feed her with her 10 grams of fat?
She of course gets good fats, and we use walnut oil and flaxseed oil mixed with a powder form of MCT, which is medium chain triglycerides. That have been broken down to a powder form that we mix with skim milk.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to give her that. So the carnitine that she takes, she has side effects every time she takes it?
She does. Mm-hmm. It seems like she definitely has increased energy, but she constantly complains of her stomach hurting, and then she has to immediately have a bowel movement. And she's 2, and it's a shame that a 2-year-old's like, "Mommy, my belly hurts."
Oh, sure, of course, of course. Have you tried drugs such as Zantac or liquid Zantac or Prilosec?
No, we haven't.
I think that's what I would do. First of all, I would talk to your doctor, but you can get it over the counter. And it's a liquid Zantac, or if she'll swallow a pill. But 2-year-olds, it's hard to get a 2-year-old to swallow a pill. But I would look at liquid Zantac, talk to your doctor, get a prescription for it. Then it'll be covered by your insurance. See if that works. That would be number one. The second thing, if she's vomiting, is there's a drug called Ondansetron, O-N-D-A-N-S-E-T-R-O-N, Ondansetron. And that drug is used for nausea. It's used for the nausea of chemotherapy. And I would try that. And it's a little tiny pill that goes under the tongue. So she doesn't even have to swallow it. She puts it in her mouth. And those are the two things that I would try in terms of one essentially for her stomach, for her gut, and the other one basically for nausea, and see if that works.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much.
Mm-hmm. You're most
thank
welcome.
Thank you so much
for
the call at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, time once again for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with something we discuss quite often, back pain. You frequently mention that a lot of what causes it is unknown, but a new theory is that it might be genetic. Is that theory holding water?
Well, we know back pain is really common. I mean, back pain is common in 20% of the population at any particular time. And we also know that that it's common in families. So whether or not there's a genetic component, it's sort of interesting. There probably is a genetic component that would make sense to me. But there's also a component of how we use our bodies. And so if we're looking at families, that would be very, very difficult to ferret out. Here it is. Yeah. You've got a family with back pain, and let's say men are affected more than women. And you've got, we'll say, a dad who played football, and then the dad teaches the son to play football. The dad has back pain from football, and the son gets back pain from football. Is it the way they're built, or is it the football? You know, nature, nurture, very difficult to say. There's probably a genetic component, but once again, we don't know what causes 50% of all back pain. We have not yet figured it out, and that's why there are so many ways of treating it.
Have a myth you want busted? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
For as long as I can remember, I've had a chronically stuffy nose. And it's always been the worst in the morning. And it tends to get better throughout the day, but certain days it's just really bad. And it's hard for me to get any kind of relief. What I've tried in the past is the over-the-counter nasal spray decongestants. And those really work well for me. But I'm afraid to take them on a regular basis, primarily because there's the warning on there that you're not supposed to take them too often, as the problem can get worse.
Yeah, I let me tell you from experience, you really can get addicted on those things. If you take them too long, you end up having to do it more and more often. And finally, it doesn't do any good at all, and it's very difficult to get off of the things. I had a terrible experience where I almost was rolling in discomfort and pain from the withdrawal. It felt like, I would imagine, heroin withdrawal would be. Maybe that's overstatement, but Zorba?
It's pretty awful. The withdrawal from over-the-counter, over-the-counter decongestants can be pretty bad. I've had problems, too, if I've used them for more than a couple of days. So the answer is yes, you don't want to use them. And they actually stop working after a while. That's what happens.
Yeah,
they don't work as well. So you've tried the over-the-counter sprays for a day or two, and they help you?
Yes, they do. They do help a lot. I am afraid to continually use them, though. And very little else offers any kind of relief. It tends to be better when there's cooler, drier air.
Mm-hmm.
If I take a warm shower in the morning, that tends to help things. Mm-hmm. Drinking warm liquids, the coffee, but it's kind of like I kind of chronically have like a minor cold all the time.
Mm-hmm. How about prescription nasal sprays? Have you gone to a doctor with this at all?
I have not. No.
Okay. I've got a great suggestion. Some people have what this is called is vasomotor rhinitis, which basically means you've got a hypersensitive mucous membrane in your nose, and this hypersensitive mucous membrane is actually causing this problem. It swells up, stops swelling, and it goes back and forth for no reason at all, no applicable reason. And quite often, a steroid nasal spray taken once a day or twice a day, a drug such as a Flonase, generic, it's a good example of a generic. Nasonex is another one that's branded. But any one of the steroid nasal sprays can make a big difference. And I would recommend you talk to your doc about it, because that'll make a difference. The other thing that is a non-pharmacological way is to start using a neti pot every day and see if that works. Have you tried a neti pot?
I have used one before. I've had a hard time getting myself to continually use it, though.
Uh-huh. Did it seem to work at all or not?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. It does offer some
Well, there is something that you put in the neti pot called Alkalol, A-L-K-O-L-O-L. And we'll put that on our website, Alkalol. And Alkalol is an old-fashioned 125-year-old remedy. Smells a little bit like Vicks VapoRub to me. It must have some eucalyptus in it. And for some people, they find that really works well, too. That's a non-pharmacological way of treating it. So I'd either go to the neti pot and with saline in the neti pot or Alkalol on one hand. Or on the other hand, what I would do is talk to your doctor about getting a steroid nasal spray and see which one will work for you.
Okay.
Good luck.
Excellent.
Good luck.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
Thank you so much for the call. Before we get out of here for the week, Zorba, you may want to run to your chambers to get your robe because we have what I think will be a brief case for Judge Zorba. Today's case comes from Donna in Janesville, Wisconsin, who's putting her sister on trial. I'll let Donna lay out the facts of the case.
It. What a sweet family.
She writes, Dr. Zorba, I'm having a dispute with my sister about tea and hope you can help. I think it's correct to assume that tea, iced or hot, contains caffeine unless otherwise stated. The same way that coffee has caffeine, unless you specifically order decaffeinated. To my sister's way of thinking, most tea is caffeine-free. So who's right?
She's right, sister wrong. Yeah. Bang, I've got my little gavel over here. Tea contains caffeine, unless it's actually processed and is decaffeinated. No, so tea doesn't have as much caffeine as coffee, but it definitely has caffeine.
The sister is not a tea drinker.
The sister is not a tea drinker. Otherwise, she would know if she drank tea all night. And in fact, it reminds me of a story. My wife and I were just married. We lived in Nova Scotia. It was wonderful. We lived at Mrs. Waters' boarding house, 78 Maple Street in Moncton, New Brunswick. We thought it was just wonderful. And she would say, honey, I love you so much that whenever you're not home, I can't get to sleep. And she's telling me this at 11 o'clock in the evening because I had finally gotten home from the hospital, drinking a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I said, do you think the tea might be the problem? And she said, no, I'm sure, honey, it's love. And I said, why don't you stop drinking tea at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and see what happens? And you know what?
It worked.
It was the tea. It wasn't the love, although she's still the love of my life.
If you need Judge Zorba to settle your lifestyle case or just to join you for tea, send an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. Oh, and don't forget, we're on Facebook, too.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor and Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg, the Ryan Braun and Prince Fielder of radio production, are the two guys responsible for this hour. If you aren't Brewers fans, you aren't going to get that one. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0910Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.